Welcome to Inside Analog Photography Radio Program. I'm your host, Scott Shepard, and of course, the Inside Analog Photography Radio Program is all about traditional process photography. We talk about instant photography. We talk about black and white. We talk about color film. We talk about dry plate, wet plate, you name it, alternate printing processes, everything going on in analog photography. And of course, the Inside Analog Photography Radio Program is brought to you by Fujifilm over at www.fujifilmusa.com/professional. They have beautiful C41 color neg, black and white, color chrome, and of course, instant. Instant film rocks. These guys have so much great things going on right now with instant film. Of course, they have the pack film in 3.25 by 4.25 and 4.5. Color, black and white, high-speed black and white, but you know what's even cooler? They have the Instax cameras and film. The Instax Wide is in the country, available everywhere. And of course, right now, brand new, the Instax Mini is now in the U.S. They have cameras. They have film. This Instax Mini is 2.5 by 3.5. It's the size of a business card. This is really fun stuff. You got to check it out. www.fujifilmusa.com/professional, making life more colorful. Our friends at Richard Photo Lab, the place to send all your film to get developed, proofs, you name it. They got a great workflow going. www.richardphotolab.com. DR5 for the most unbelievable proprietary process to turn your black and white film into positives, into chrome. You won't believe until you get your film back as a piece of chrome will blow your mind. The dynamic range, the latitude, it's just unbelievable stuff. Definitely check it out. www.dr5.com. Iger Studios, Lenny Iger, the place to have high-resolution scans done. You know, a lot of people now are shooting analog. They're using a high-resolution scan. They're making digital negatives on an inkjet. Or maybe they're going straight to an inkjet output, but they're making digital negatives and they're printing contact prints. They're doing all the stuff you need to get a high-resolution scan. They're using an Aztec Premier, 8,000 PPI, adjustable aperture. They can give you scans that are basically grain-free. They can adjust it for every kind of film out there. This is crazy stuff going on with Lenny Iger and the guys at Iger Studios. Check them out, igerstudios.com. And, of course, Upstrap at upstrap-pro.com. The camera strap that will not slide off your shoulder. Our media partners, www.apug.org, the Analog Photography User Group. The place on the web for all things analog process. This is a great place to learn, to share information, to get tips and tricks. The community for analog photography, www.apug.org. And of course, our photographic philanthropy partner, George Eastman House International Museum of Photography and Film, www.geh.org. The place to go to find out about the history of traditional analog photography. These people are keeping this alive. They have over 7,000 cameras in their museum of everything that's ever been made, including the Hasselblads that were shot on the moon. You name it. They have the collection. This is a great way to help support. You can be a member of George Eastman House organization. They have a lot of great things going on, but this is something you can do to help give back to photography, to help keep traditional analog photography alive for generations to come. Definitely check them out, www.geh.org. This week on Inside Analog Photo, we're going to have with us Todd Gustafson. Todd is the curator of technology at George Eastman House International Museum of Photography and Film. Todd takes care of course, all of the cameras. He is the one that has the permanent collection of all of the technology at the George Eastman House. He's just written a brand new book that's over the top, very cool. It's called Camera, A History of Photography, from daguerreotype to digital. Todd, how you doing today, buddy?
Oh, pretty good. Having a great day out here.
Thanks for joining us here on Inside Analog Photo. Great to have you on the program talking about George Eastman House International Museum of Film and Photography. Now, you're the curator of technology, so you get to be in charge of all the cool gear, all the lenses and the camera bodies and you name it. If it has anything to do about making a photograph, they have to see Todd. You're the man.
Right. I'm the gatekeeper. Pretty amazing collection here. We're the oldest photographic museum in the world, actually, started in 1949. And we collect from all manufacturers, by the way. It isn't just Rochester-based. So we hold literature from close to 10,000 manufacturers worldwide and objects, actually, from about 1,000. So pretty big collection.
And you cover everything. So we're talking cameras, projectors, viewers for old handheld mono and stereo pictures, lenses, you name it. You got it.
Yeah, we have it. And when you say stereo, we even have stereo mounts. So the things that you'd put your stereo slides in, we'd have that too. So pretty good size, soup to nuts kind of collection.
Let's start off here with some of the stuff you have, because you have some pieces that are just unbelievable. And I think everybody loves a great photograph, but I think part of being the photographer is part of the obsession with gear, I think, to a point.
It's part of the affliction, I suppose, but yeah. With the exception of Man Ray, I guess you need a light bulb for that, but you need a camera to make an image for the most part. We have an example of the Giroux daguerreotype camera in the collection, which would be the world's first commercially manufactured and sold cameras from 1839. We have the oldest documented sale of a camera in the U.S., complete with its receipt and about a dozen images that were made by it, and up until modern stuff. We collect digital. We have a Leica M8 on display, which we're fortunate enough to have one of those donated by the kind folks at the Lights Company. So yeah, it's just an unbelievable collection.
What is the most requested piece of gear that people want to see? I mean, everything that's there. What do people want to see most?
It's really kind of an interesting study. You have people who have been interested in these sorts of things their entire life, so they want to come in and see whatever piece lights their fancy these days. The daguerreotype stuff have been kind of hot, so people want to see the Lewis-style daguerreotype camera. The Giroux, certainly, or the Bemis, which is that first U.S. sole camera. And then you get into people who want to have, I don't know, their childhood or whatever verified by knowing that their Instamatic 100 is in the collection or a Brownie. So it's really kind of all over the map.
Do you typically have people contacting you, Todd, saying, hey, I got some gear you wanted? I mean, how do you go about accepting pieces for the collection?
Museums collect in kind of unusual ways. We have habits of getting in onesies and twosies from the kind folks out there who want to help us build the collection. And then we end up taking on corporate gifts. So we'll get onesies, twosies, and then several thousand at a time. So it's an interesting thing. And the other thing that I think relative to private collectors, this is industrial collecting, if you would. This is a collection that I personally manage, but personally did not go and acquire all of them. I mean, I probably have added maybe 20 or so percent to the collection in my 20 years of being here. But just the kindness of strangers, if you would, that's how the collection was built.
So let's talk about you being at Eastman House for 20 years. How did you get involved in Eastman House, and how did you even get involved in being a curator of technology?
Yeah, well, I'll tell you, it wasn't a life plan. I studied photography in college, fine art photography. I've always been interested in photography. I got out of school, worked in another museum, actually being a photographer, and I just sort of happened to fall into this in a way. I mean, I came along when our archive building was being built. So I basically was hired to move the collection and liked working here, and I've just sort of stayed. I've kind of like grown up with the collection, if you would.
So you worked your way through different levels to become the head curator of technology.
Yeah, I started out as the gopher, and now I'm the curator, so sort of an odd way to do it. Although, on the other hand, when it comes to these sort of things, it's probably the only way you really can do it. Most of what we have here, you're not really going to see anyplace else, or at least a fair bit of the earlier things. They just only exist in museums. The only way you can acquire this knowledge is to do it firsthand.
So let's talk about the vault, how cameras are stored. Do you have these things just sitting on pallet racks, on shelves? Are they in special dehumidified chambers? I mean, how do you store some of these cameras?
Well, we do have a vault. Generically, it's like the Home Depot of cameras. We have pallet racking. The vault itself is purpose-built. It's climate controlled, highly secured. We keep things at 68 degrees and 45% humidity. Everything receives a museum number, which is how we track in our computer system. It also will describe where it is, who we got it from, what it is, and where we put it. But as I said, it's a climate-controlled warehouse.
Now, because it's all climate-controlled and it's all good, these cameras can just sit out in open shelving, dust-free and clean, and everything's happy with it.
Yeah, the vault is filtered, so it is dust-free. The only dust in here we unfortunately brought in when I walked in the door, so to speak. Some of it's open shelving. We have a couple of compact storage units, sort of more akin to industrial parts storage, sort of a robotic controlled unit. We have some closed off cabinets. Some of it has to do with what we're storing. We built some housing for certain things depending on how fragile they are. But in general, you do want to keep the air circulating around. I don't know exactly how often we change the air per hour in the room, but you do want to have things circulating. Otherwise, you're liable to get mold growth or whatever like that, even though it's dry. We do circulate the air.
So when people want to look at a camera or do research on something, can they actually put their hands on some of this gear and do a formal request to come in and view, let's say, some field camera or something of the sort?
Yeah, we take appointments, and it's really going to depend on exactly what they want to see. I mean, sometimes if it's not too many things, I can bring them out to our study area for that. And a lot of times that makes sense because you'll also want to look at our printed literature when it comes to many of these products. If they want to see a lot of things in general, it's actually easier just to bring them into the vault to kind of walk through. I think people really enjoy doing that anyway. It kind of gives them the feeling of just being in the vault. I'm kind of disappointed if I bring somebody in here and I don't get some sort of a wow as soon as I walk in the door, because it is kind of overwhelming if you haven't seen it before. It's all this stuff lined up. We take appointments. Generally, I appreciate a week's notice in advance. Basically, anything we have here is open for study for anybody who wants to come and see it.
Wow. I mean, you have some incredible stuff. Don't you guys have the Hasselblad that they used on the moon?
We have a lunar Hasselblad. Ours actually was donated to us by Dr. Hasselblad, as a matter of fact, but it was not used by NASA. So it left Sweden and came to Rochester, and it stayed here. So it didn't go into orbit, but it's just like the ones that did.
But you have the lunar orbiter system, too.
The lunar orbiter is currently, it's actually currently on display, by the way. That's a payload camera that was made by Eastman Kodak Company for mapping the moon for the Apollo program. Basically, it was used in the 60s. They made enough parts to build about 10 of those things. They used 6, and the one we have was a fly model that was not used. So the ones that were used actually all crashed into the surface of the moon. So the ones we have that are here didn't go.
But nevertheless, very, very rare, cool stuff. I've seen the one on display. It's cool.
It's actually one of the real prime pieces in the collection.
What do you figure is your most prime piece? That if you had to say this is our most rarest, most expensive, highest valued piece?
Well, that'd be the Giroud Daguerreotype camera. It's the first camera signed by Daguerre, seal on the side with his signature on it. There are none in private hands, and this is the only one in the U.S., so pretty amazing camera. And the condition is basically mint. It's like it was made yesterday.
Most of the cameras that you guys take in the collection are pretty much in mint condition, or do you have some stuff that's pretty well beat, too?
We have a selection. Sometimes we'll have actually a real nice, brand-new-in-the-box version that we got from possibly one of the companies that made it. But on the other hand, I also like to display things that got used. Like, for instance, we have a couple of Leica A's or Model 1s, if you would, in the collection. I have two that are pretty much pristine, and I've got one that's really beat. There's no black paint left on it. And again, it shows you that these things actually were used. So depending on the exhibition that we're going to use it in association with, putting up things that are typical of what things would be when they're used is fine with me. And then you get into cameras that were used by famous photographers. We've got Alfred Stieglitz's Eastman View, and it received a lot of wear. I mean, he used this camera heavily for many, many years, and certainly the fact that he used it is what makes the camera interesting.
No, I think that's just what's so great about what you guys do with the collection. And also, people probably don't know that you have other equipment, darkroom stuff. I mean, you probably have enlargers, you name it, it's over there.
Yeah, we have solar enlargers. We have pretty much a reasonable selection on it. And again, just due to the size of our warehouse space, we don't want to have one of everything that was ever made. That just wouldn't really work out into the space, and can't imagine how much space you'd actually need for that. Probably take up half the state of New York to house all this stuff. But yeah, we collect a reasonable sample, I guess. I mean, part of my rule of thumb is the concept of what will people want to look at 50 years from now. So I always kind of keep that in the back of my mind when I start to go out and acquire things.
So I guess the Sears and Roebuck enlarger is probably not something someone's really going to want to see in 50 years. But like you said, a solar enlarger or something that had a big value to it or changed the way of technology moved is something you would look at as a curator saying, okay, well, this was something that was important at the time that made it better or different.
Yeah, and part of this, as I said, unfortunately, it does come down to space. The collection is heaviest in cameras because that's pretty much what sort of runs the technology of photography. We do have some industrial-related things in the collection. We have a barrel that was used for making emulsion at Eastman Kodak Company back in the 1890s. We've been actually acquiring, some bits of industrial manufacturing as things change a little bit. But yeah, again, we try to kind of keep our eye on the ball of what the mission is, which is we collect the history of photography. So that sort of is generally where it goes. For the most part, it is consumer-driven. So industrial things have its own little niche, just like we do have some scientific apparatus in the collection, the little bits of things that we've collected over the years, a lot of times from the University of Rochester's laser lab, but generally speaking, consumer products.
Typically, as being a museum, do you get everything donated? Do you ever have to buy gear? Like, we really want to add this collection, but it's going to cost us $100,000. I mean, how do you do acquisitions when you guys actually want something, or maybe you find something?
It's really going to depend on what it is. I mean, I do have a small budget to buy some things per year. If it's a big collection, we'd actually have to go raise the funds to do it. And we've had a lot of people who have been quite generous with us over the years. I look at a lot of things. Sometimes I'll make trips to actually go look at large collections. But again, we have to live with our budget, so unfortunately it's not unlimited. We certainly always welcome to accept donations, both for objects and collection. But in some ways, it's no different from a private collector. There's usually kind of a list of things that you'd like to have for the collection for various reasons. In the case of the Eastman House, if it's something that I had to have right now, usually I'd have to go buy it, unless I can sweet-talk somebody into donating something. I'm a pretty patient guy. If there's something out there that I'd like to have, if I don't have to have it right now, my feeling is eventually it'll find its way here, because in reality, it usually does.
Right, so if I see it now or in 5 years, whatever, it'll be around.
If I'm working on an exhibition or the museum's working on an exhibition on something specific that I got to have right now, I can usually come up with a way of getting it. But normally I try to be patient. How many favors do you want to call in on a daily basis? After a while, they stop being favors that can be called in. And we've got some friends in the industry that we can usually work out a pretty reasonable price on things like that if it's on new product. The older product gets a little more complicated.
Let's talk about supplies. You guys actually have old film and paper and packaging and stuff like that.
Yeah, we more likely call it just the packaging collection. We're really more interested in what's on the outside than what's on the inside. Unfortunately, once you open a package of film, it's kind of done. And usually people are interested in the boxes that it came in. We do have a conservation department that at times gets into, I don't know if you want to call it photography by the micron, but they do tend to get into this stuff. And it really will, in the case of that stuff, would depend on what grant they have that'll pay for the research.
Right. Hork them last rolls of Kodachrome.
Yeah. Well, actually, we're supposed to get the last rolls of Kodachrome shortly. In fact, I think off to Steve McCurry to shoot with. In fact, he doesn't know it yet, but I'm going to put the tap on to see if I can acquire the camera that he made the last images with, too. So.
There you go.
So the pressure is now on, right?
Pull out that old Nikon F100 and say, here, you can have it, too. Enjoy.
Yeah, he was using an F100 or FM. Either would be fine.
Like you said, it'd be great at some point to do a great little display with some Kodachrome stuff.
We've actually had a pretty good relationship with Steve. We did an exhibition of his work here at the time. He loaned us various things of his, including his hiking boots. And I think we had his FM2 that he used at the time. I think he was still using his F100. But he's sort of switched over to digital these days for the most part, I think. And we take those too.
Now, with acquisition, I mean, let's say Canon's got a new 1D Mark IV. Are they just going to automatically box one up and send it to you guys, or do you have to go down the road and try to get one? Do these manufacturers, do they know the importance of this stuff and they just send you gear?
Oh boy, it'd be nice if they did. It really depends on the company. I mean, sometimes it can be a fairly simple phone call to the public relations department. Other times there's a little bit more arm twisting involved. Some companies have been friendlier with us than others. Usually I can find a way, again, if it's something that I need to have, whether it comes from the company or a friendly vendor, one or the other.
Now, you have literature, too, correct?
Yeah, in literature, in the old days, everything was printed on reasonably decent paper, if you go back far enough. And actually, the literature in my collection is roughly, say, 1880 and newer. The material older than that is actually in our library rare book department. So if you want to read an original Giroux Daguerreotype manual written by Daguerre, we do have those, actually in multiple languages, but that's not stored in my department. The newer thing is a little more complicated because most of it's digital. We, at times, have at least had the theoretical conversation about you should print everything you see as HTML and archive it someplace. And I'm thinking, well, there's a project. But resources are the main limiting factor when it comes to any of these conversations.
So talking about really cool stuff that's been printed, let's talk about your brand new book. This thing is over the top cool. And any photographer has got to get this book. This thing is way too cool.
Well, thank you. It's a project that the museum worked on for about 3 years or so. I had quite a few consultants helping with various details of things. I'm kind of, in some ways, the writer-producer of this. I did a bit of writing and a bit of delegating also. The goal here was to try to get as accurate as we could possibly do, given the time we had to do it in. And given my tenure here, I've had contact with a lot of collectors who specifically know certain things much better than I do. I'm kind of a general guy, if you would. So we tried to do it in such a way that it'd also be a book that would be of interest for somebody who's just generally interested in the subject. So, I mean, had kind of a goal of making it an interesting read cover to cover, but also realize that the majority of people are going to look at it kind of like People magazine. They're going to read one or two pages and flip through. So we try to make everything stand up to both of those little tests.
So when doing the book, and the name of the book's called Camera, correct?
I know. How clever.
How did you pick what you wanted to have in the book? Let's explain to people. So you have the book, you have a camera, and then you show the image that was shot with that camera.
Yeah, well, first of all, the museum has kind of been built that way to collect the history of photography. So we have the images, but also go back to the fact that in specific cases, we will have the camera that made a specific image, and other times an image, a camera of this type was used. So we tried to put things together in such a way that, at least to the best of my knowledge, hadn't really been done before. I mean, we had an exhibit kind of like this a few years ago, but try to make it kind of interesting to see this is what made that picture. Was kind of keeping that in mind, and actually, I guess the way this got started is trying to figure out, well, where do you start? That's the earliest camera, and then what do you end with? Well, that's the latest one we had in the collection. And my thinking is, well, what do you need in between to get there? I tried to pick what would make sense to get you from point A to point B relative to the 8,000 or so cameras that we have in the collection.
What do you think, Todd, of all the stuff that you've been doing for years here with the museum, and of course being a photographer yourself that we'll get into here in a second, but what do you figure that's the most important camera that was made? Not because it was on the moon or went to Mars or went underground or the center of the earth or whatever, but with all the stuff that you've seen and all the photographs, what is something camera-wise that's really important when it comes to the photography?
Oh, without a doubt, it's the Brownie. The Brownie from 1900 pretty much turned photography to something that was done either exclusively by a professional photographer or the fairly well-to-do to giving anybody who wanted to take a picture access to do it. I mean, the original camera sold for $1. Roll of film for 6 exposures was 15 cents. Processing was an additional 40 cents. Now, those sound like fairly inexpensive numbers, but you got to put it back in 1900. But it's still found to be the product that just most changed the industry, hands down.
And of all the work you did in the book, what's your favorite piece that you put together when it comes to the combination of a camera and an image? Not historically wise, not museum wise, but what's your favorite piece out of the book?
Well, in a way, that's sort of like asking a parent, who's your favorite child? For me personally, the Kodak EasyShare 1 and the image that was made with that, I made that image. It's actually an image of a boat that I co-own with a friend of mine. So that has kind of more of a personal thing for me. There are also things about that camera that I really like. It's a Wi-Fi camera, so first you could actually send and receive images to. So it's almost like a photographic BlackBerry at the time. This is from 2006. But as far as the other things that really strike a chord with me, I've always been kind of an Icon F guy. Just from my days of photography, it's one of those cameras that I always wanted when I was a kid, and then I bought one. I've used it for years. These days it tends to sit in the case, unfortunately. The one in the book is just an incredibly mint black one, which is something that I would have even significantly lusted after as a child. The Coburn's Delta Reflex that he used to make the octopus image is a great piece. The Stieglitz Eastman View, of course, another one, used to make the image of Georgie O'Keeffe's hands on the V8 Ford hubcap. Things like that. And again, they're just the crown jewels of the collection, if you would.
So, Todd, tell me about your photography. Are you still shooting stuff? Do you still even want to look at a camera after working at this stuff every day? Do you ever get bored of the whole photography realm itself?
Well, I still shoot a bit. I photograph a lot of cameras, mostly for a database. I enjoy that. I do a bit of photography on my own. I've actually been tinkering a little bit with some soft focus imagery. I've actually mounted the lens from a vest pocket Kodak. The meniscus lens into a mount that I use on a digital camera, which is kind of interesting. I suppose you could probably recreate these with various Photoshop filters, but going back to the way it was originally done is kind of neat. And digital actually makes some of this possible. I mean, in the old days, trying to figure out what the exposure would be pretty tough, where now you can just quickly look at the LCD on the back and say, that's better open that up a little bit. But that's what I've been doing lately. And of course, the occasional friend's wedding, not necessarily my favorite thing to do, but...
But you'll do it if someone begs enough?
Yeah, if my arm gets twisted far enough, I'll do it, sure.
So what do you look forward to here at Eastman House? I know it's very important. And I mean, this is one of the great things that if you're a member of Eastman House, you can actually contact you. And let's say if you want to go look at some old brass lens, you have one. People can check it out. If they want to look at a film holder for something obscure, you have it. I mean, I think this is one of the great things that's so cool about being a member of the George Eastman House. Is you get access to people like yourself and your collection and help with things. Let's say someone's restoring a Century Number 7. I'm sure you probably have one on the shelf they could look at.
They probably have 3 or 4 of them. and by the way, you don't necessarily just have to be a member of the museum. We certainly do appreciate that. But if somebody wants to just come in and see something, we're open for appointment, not just for members. Lenses-wise, we've got about 1,500 lenses. We have the lenses that Coburn used for his soft focus photography made by Pinkham & Smith. We've got a set of those. We've got a lot of brass portrait lenses. We recently took on a fairly large collection of lenses from Eastman Kodak Company, basically a sample of every lens they ever made. It's a pretty amazing collection there. The lens is really the ticket. I mean, that's what makes photography photography.
Yeah, I would love to have an Eastman Aero Ektar 2.5.
And the strength to hold it up. They're a pretty big lens.
Yeah, I'm sure you probably have one or two of those laying around there, too.
Yeah, and some of the brass portrait lenses we have from the early part of the 1900s. Dr. Kingslake, who is the first lens designer for Eastman Kodak Company, great guy, was working here when I first started, believe it or not. But anyway, he used to call some of these things 35-pounders, which had to do with how much they weigh. These are pretty good-sized lenses, some of them.
But like you said, I mean, you can try to recreate this in Photoshop, but it's all about the glass. And I mean, the access that you guys have to this stuff is just amazing, and people can actually study it. And I think that's one reason why I just keep pushing people to join George Eastman House, because for the $30, $50 a year, the benefits you get, even if you don't live in town, if you want to make that once-a-year trip, it's an incredible resource.
Yeah, our staff is really open to this stuff. We try to do what we can, really go out of our way to assist people in whatever their research interests would be. So, yeah, it's just probably second to none. You're not going to see anything else like this, period.
No, and I haven't even been in your technology room. I was in the vault for the photographs itself. And even to go over there and look at a piece of Kodachrome 8x10 from the mid-50s is worth the money right off the bat, just to look at one image.
Yeah, no, it is pretty hard to imagine when you just walk in the door here. And it's just here for the asking, as the saying goes.
So what do you look forward to as being the curator of the technology collection at Eastman House, but even more so as a photographer? What do you look forward to in the future here with some gear you haven't got a hold of yet? Maybe something you got your eye on? I mean, what keeps Todd just charged up about this and what you're doing?
There's a number of things going around right now. Within the last couple of years, we managed to redo the entire storage system in here. I added a second floor to the vault, so I suddenly have twice as much space. Got a lot of material that has been coming to us from Eastman Kodak Company. They've been just unbelievably generous, I should say, over the years. Currently working on another book that's sort of in its infancy.
Really?
Yeah, one on the brownie. We've got some other probable ones that we will do in the near future. There's talk of another camera book, maybe more cameras, less information. I'd love to do a book on cinema. Cinema is basically knowledge that I've acquired here, still working on it. I know that'd be an interesting project. As far as products go, I keep updating my wish list because the boxes keep getting checked off. So currently, I'd like to get my hands on what they either call the Roberts or a Boston daguerreotype camera. That'd be the only major American daguerreotype camera that we don't have in the collection. And usually what happens with this sort of stuff is the things that I don't know about tend to be the ones that are really most interesting. Is this stuff that either I haven't seen or is rare or just somehow or other managed to just fall through the cracks. Our collection is unusual in that, as I've tried to explain to more people, is we have a lot of things that you'd never guess in a million years that we would have, and then there's a few other things that you'd figure that we should have, and we just don't. So there's some common things that I'd like to track down also. Digital-wise, in the process of acquiring a fairly good-sized digital collection from a very fine gentleman from the West Coast, basically giving us his entire collection over a period of time. Another great guy has given us his entire collection of sub-miniature cameras, anything 35mm half-frame or smaller. That's just amazing, the stuff that shows up, kind of almost on an unpredictable daily basis.
You just get boxes in the mail and you open up, you have no idea what's in them.
Yeah, you never know what's going to happen when I pick up the phone. My phone just says outside call, and you never know what's going to be on the other side of that. And again, that's where the majority of this collection has come from.
Now, what if the museum has, let's say, three of one camera? Do you sell two of them off to raise funds to help get other gear? I mean, how many Century No. 7 studio cameras do you need in 8x10? That kind of stuff, do you thin things out to acquire more cool stuff you don't have?
It really varies with objects. I mean, in the case of, say, the original Kodak camera from 1888, I think we have six of them in the collection. One of them has been disassembled, so it's an exploded view. We have the sixth one, number six, never was sold, and we've got a couple that are still loaded with film. On things like that, because we do loan to other museums or we may travel on exhibition and something like that, it's a great idea to have more than one. And also on a camera like that, there's actually a little bit of production vary, so the cameras are slightly different over the years. As far as how many Argus C3s do I have, that sort of stuff, I actually probably have about a half a dozen Argus C3s made over a period of years. We have sold things in the past to put back into the collection. It's a little more complicated for museums to do that than private collectors. Keep in mind that I'm the keeper or the steward of this collection. It belongs to George Eastman House, so we have kind of a longer view of this than I think most collectors do.
And then what are you shooting for your personal photography? Are you doing landscape? What are you doing these days? Are you doing any fine artwork? Or is there enough just shooting cameras at work that keeps you happy with your art?
I do a little bit of everything, actually. I shoot some portraits, I shoot some landscapes. I do quite a bit of tabletop photography.
All digital now, or are you still shooting film?
Well, I shot film up until a couple of years ago. I remember trying to track down some Kodachrome in a local store, and they didn't have any in stock. I want to run through my M3 Leica, and And we've actually been using digital photography in the museum for quite a while, the way of providing access to the collection electronically with the internet. And we used to shoot film and then scan everything. Of course, that's an extra step, extra cost. So we've been kind of tinkering that way, and I finally decided for one of those anniversary birthdays that I'd rather not think too hard about, decided to just go buy an actual real camera. So I sort of switched digital, I admit it.
But, I mean, I've even heard, I mean, it's really the truth, I've heard that even in Rochester, it's hard to go find and buy film. That you wouldn't think it's basically the film photography capital of the world, and it's hard to go buy gear sometimes.
Yeah, it's just kind of the way the world is. Stores have to stay in business. If it's not moving, it's not moving. I actually spent a bit of time standing behind a counter in a camera shop in my early out of college days. It was a good learning experience. But I was working on an image for our annual report, just to give an example. And it was kind of difficult lighting and difficult exposures. And if I was shooting this on film, it probably would have taken me, I suspect maybe 3-4 days between back and forth trips to the lab and looking at the chromes and a lot of bracketing. This is the sort of thing in digital photography I can do in an hour. You know, I mean, and in fact, you question whether you actually would have ever got the image the way you wanted it on film. One of my colleagues next door does all sorts of fairly complicated manipulations, digital photography, adjusting lighting or the exposure under certain minor areas of the image. And there's just no way you could really do that in a color photograph. This wouldn't work. A lot of things you can do digitally that you just could not do on film.
It's just amazing. I think people really need to make a trip to Rochester to see what you guys have going. And definitely the book more so, because you can get a taste of what's going on with what you're doing with the technology collection, the overview and all that, with the book called Camera.
Yeah, and the other thing we do here is we do have a gentleman who does historic process. So if you are interested in knowing how to make a daguerreotype or wet plate photography, we got somebody here who does that. If you want to coat your own dry plates, well, we can single coat. You're not going to put down multi-layers, I don't think. And there's a certain amount of appreciation that you get with the way that things used to be done versus the way it's done now. I know I've had some conversations with some folks who want to sort of equate, gee, it's not the same. And historically, these things have always changed. I can envision going back 120 years ago or something like that with somebody saying that, gee, these collodion negatives just aren't the same as working with daguerreotypes. So I'm sure it's been going on that way forever. It's kind of human nature.
The new book is just incredible. I know it's getting great reviews, and it's hit bestseller status over at Amazon. It's pretty cool.
Yeah, we've been really excited with how well it's selling. I mean, when we put this together, we wanted to make a general interest, attractive volume. It's sort of nice to see that maybe we succeeded.
No, I think you have, and it's perfect timing with the release of it and the holidays coming up. It's a half book. There's some weight to it. It's on good paper. I mean, it's something definitely that anybody that likes photography or photographs in general, the technology behind these images, definitely want to pick up. It's a cool book.
Yeah, and you're not on our payroll either.
No, I'm not. So I can attest to it that the book is beautiful. You did a lot of work. The photographs are beautiful, and it just goes to show how much you guys do to collect all of these crazy old cameras and all this great stuff, and even new technology. I mean, people wouldn't think of George Eastman House collecting digital cameras, but you have them.
Yeah. Well, also keep in mind, our studio photographer did a great job. All the images in that book, with the exception of the samples that I shot, were done in our studio here. So I had an assistant that got to roll them down to the studio, keep track of all these files. We shot, I think it was something on the order of 1,500 images were made of the 350-some-odd cameras in there. We shot lots of angles, lots of views, lots of details, trying to work with the designer to give them the best possible outcome. Just an enormous amount of work to do that, and she did a great job there.
And I guess people need to realize, too, that sales from this book, proceeds go back to Eastman House.
Oh, sure. It helps to do something like this. It generates some income, which we certainly can use these days. And people don't understand how much money it costs to run these organizations. Just trying to envision what it costs to pay our electric bill, for instance, to climate control the vault that I'm standing in right now. Just an amazing amount of money. This will help do that. It also will help promote the collection, get the information out there. Certainly a lot less complicated to travel books than it is to pack up and travel exhibitions from the collection. So this is just a real easy way to do it. And it also gives you a way of seeing it, just like I said, different angles of view of these specific cameras. Some of these things, when they're on display, you can kind of see it, but you can't see the label that might be on the bottom in the case of some of these things. And we tried to illustrate that when possible.
I think people really need to go visit Eastman House, contact you. Even though you don't need a membership, it's so economical. And photographers need to give back to what you guys are doing, because it's just keeping photography alive when it comes to history and historic process. And you never know, today you might be into black and white, but next week you might want to do wet plate, and you can go see Mark Osterman, or they can go see you and look at this gear, or even go look at a wet plate film holder and look at this stuff and say, that's what I need. I didn't know I needed this little relief here to go make one. Or whatever it is. I mean, you have the stuff that people can look at if they want to even try to reproduce this old gear for their own use.
Well, not only that, especially you mentioned Mark, we have what was originally used, and seeing he does do these sorts of things, it was originally built this way, but if you want to use it, you might not want to go that route, because it just flat out isn't going to work. A certain percentage of our visitors are exactly that, people who want to come in and continue to use the old process. And where else can you go to come and see what an old plate holder looks like for wet plate process? The process was kind of corrosive. Most of those are gone. You may find the camera, but you're not going to find the holder. And then also you can talk to people who actually know what works, what doesn't work. In the old days, if you wanted to be a photographer, you'd go apprentice with a professional. So here's an opportunity to just come to the Eastman House and deal with people who have that knowledge and are willing to pass it on. Unbelievable.
Yeah, it is unbelievable. And like I said, the work you guys are doing is just too cool. And that's why people should just go to Rochester, book in a hotel for a week or two, and go hang out and drop some money and buy some stuff at the store and just enjoy the whole experience, because it really is altogether a complete experience when you go there. It's pretty cool.
Very few places you're going to see what we have here, just from the complete history of one specific thing concentrated in one building, or in the case of us, mansion to a building. So yeah, pretty amazing stuff.
It is. Todd, thanks a lot, buddy. I really appreciate it. Look forward to chatting with you again, talking about the book some more, some of these other projects you're doing, and just great work you're doing. This new book is over the top. It's beautiful, and I really appreciate it, buddy.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
Well, there you go. Todd Gustafson, curator of technology, George Eastman House International Photography and Film, author, Camera, A History of Photography from Daguerreotype to Digital, and just a really cool guy. Great stories and a most unbelievable, beautiful book. You definitely have to check this stuff out. Check out the George Eastman House. Really great things they're doing for photography to extend this stuff, to teach people about traditional processes. It's just a great organization. You definitely got to check out their website and what they're up to. The Inside Analog Photography radio program has been brought to you by Fujifilm, making life more colorful, over at www.fujifilmusa.com. Our friends at Richard Photo Lab at richardphotolab.com. DR5 over at www.dr5.com. Iger Studios over at igerstudios.com. Upstrap at upstrap-pro.com. And of course, our media partners, APUG, the Analog Photography User Group, over at www.apug.org. Our photography philanthropy partners, George Eastman House International Museum of Photography and Film, over at www.geh.org. I've been your host, Scott Chipper, here on Inside Analog Photography Radio. We'll be back next week with more great analog photography.